Okay, good day to everyone. I'm broadcasting from beautiful Ottawa, the capital of Canada. It's quite a beautiful city. I'm visiting here for 3 days to help train the staff of the Hillel School on the Arvishinanta Mishna program, which is now going to be in the coming year in 50 of the leading schools around North America, up from 30 from this year. And we have already a list of 10-15 schools that are waiting for the program for next year, since we can only absorb so many schools at one time, Baruch Hashem. In our last meetings, we've been discussing various types of sugyot in the Bavli, using as our examples the first sugyot in Masechet Bava Metzia Perek HaMafkid. We've learned that the sugyot subdivide into two main categories, which is Amoreik sugyot and Stama sugyot, sugyot of the Stama Digmara. And we've learned that the way that they're differentiated from each other is that Amoreik sugyot are built on a core, a pre-existing core of Memrot of Amoraim that are presented in chronological sequence. And this can be identified by the pre-scanning of the sugya, the identifying of the Amoraim, and the mapping of the Amoraim according to their Batei Midrash and their generations. And when we see in an Amoreik sugya that the Amoraim are the core of the sugya, that they're presented in chronological sequence, we learn them first, and then we go back and learn the Stama de Gemara on top of the Amoraim as a Pirush, the way we learn Pirush Rashi on Chumash. The Amoraim and the Stama de Gemara are operating with two separate goals and levels. The Amoraim are dealing with Psak Halacha and its details, while the Stama de Gemara is generally dealing with the interpretation of the Amoraim, the explanation of their Svara, etc. The second type of sugya, the Stama sugya, developed during the period of the Balaya sugya, which is either at the very end of the Amoraik period or very shortly thereafter in the Saboraik period. And even though Amoraim may appear in a Stama sugya, they'll appear more as quotations, not because they're locals, as we say, not locals in the sugya, but rather imported quotations to prove the point that the Stama is trying to explain. And these two types of sugyas, Amoraik sugyas and Stama sugyas, are the two main categories of sugyot and shas. And it's important when you learn a sugya first to determine, before you learn it for content, it's important to determine what kind of sugya it is, whether it's one type or the other, because the approach that you need to use to learn the sugyas are opposite. In the Amoraik sugyas, you learn Amoraim first and then Stama, whereas in Stama sugyo, you learn the Stama and then the Amoraim. So it's important to know exactly what type of sugya you're looking at before you learn it. Now, among Amoraik sugyas, we've seen various types. We've seen in the first sugya, we saw a sugya which is primarily from one Beit Midrash, which involved Rami Bar Chama and Rava and Rabbi Zera. And then we saw sugyot that were international, that began in Tveria with Rabbi Yochanan and then moved to Bavel in the fifth generation with Rav Papa. Today, we're going to look at a third type of Amoraik sugya, which we term natural sugyot. The two types of sugyot that we learned previously were what we might call edited sugyot, in the sense that the Amoraim, the statements of the Amoraim, the Memrot, were edited and then and gradually accumulated in the sugya one on top of the other. But we didn't see in those sugyot Amoraim sitting and speaking with each other live in a dialogue or based on an event, something that happened. We didn't see that. They were statements, legal statements, apodictic remarks that were edited together and became a sugya. Today, we're going to see a natural sugya. And natural sugyot, the idea of natural sugyot is that they're sugyot either of dialogues between Amoraim or sugyot that are built up over an incident that took place. And as the story is told, we learn what the psak halacha is. The difference between natural sugyot and edited sugyot among Amoraik sugyot is that natural sugyot are very often in Aramaic, whereas edited sugyot, the Amoraim are virtually always in Hebrew. The reason for this is not exactly clear, but it is factually the case. Out of the 10,000 sugyot in Shas, we have about 6,000 that are Amoraik sugyas and about 4,000 Stama sugyas. And out of the 6,000 Amoraik sugyas, we have several hundred sugyot that are natural, and all the rest are edited. So we're going to learn a natural sugya, number 5 today in the Perek. And Jay is asking, are they in Aramaic because they're talking to each other? Yes, they spoke in Aramaic. That's clear. The question is, why didn't their students edit the dialogues into Hebrew the way they edited the Mimrot into Hebrew? The Mimrot were also originally said in Aramaic in the Yeshiva, and were only edited at a later time into Hebrew. So why didn't they edit the dialogues into Hebrew? That's not clear, as far as I don't know any good explanation for it. But let's take a look at this sugya number 5, in Perek HaMafkid, and we'll see what we find. Okay? Are there any questions about the principle that I've explained before we go into the actual sugya? Feel free to speak or to write.
Does it have the same thing in front of them, and just want to get a quick image of being just in our website for motion, just have 18 minutes and study material number 3, so you can listen to the short. If you don't have it, it's on our website as well.
Okay, so let's take a look at number 5. The sugya begins as follows. Hahu gavra de afkid kipe gabe chavre. Hahu gavra, that person, there was a certain person, de afki kipe, that entrusted jewelry, gabe chavre, to his friend. Now, many, many halachic stories in the Gemara begin with the phrase hahu gavra, that person. It happened with a certain person, and as this one does, amarle, and then he said to him, this person who entrusted the jewelry to his friend came back at a later date and said to him, havli kipai, give me back my jewelry. Amarle lo yadana hecha odvinu, and he said to him, the guardian said back to him, I don't know where I put them. I don't know where I put the jewelry. Ata lekame de Rav Nachman. This case came before Rav Nachman. This is Rav Nachman bar Yaakov, who was the dayan in Nahar De'ah in the second generation. He was a talmid of Rav Ada bar Ava. And he was a dayan in Nahar De'ah during the time of Shmuel. Originally, he was from Mechoza, and his prime pupil is Rava, who is known to us from the fourth generation. So the case came before Rav Nachman to his Beit Din, Amar Le, and Rav Nachman said to the guardian, Kol lo yadana shiutehi. Any time a person says, I don't know what happened to something, I was entrusted with it, I don't know what happened to it, shiutehi, that's considered pesha, that's considered negligence. Zil shalem, go pay. You don't know where the jewelry is, pay the man for his jewelry. La shilem, he didn't pay. He didn't listen to the psak din of Rav Nachman. Azal Rav Nachman, ag bie le'abdane mine. So what did Rav Nachman do to this fellow who refused to pay? He had his agents go to his house and to compound, to confiscate his furniture in order to pay for the jewelry. Lasof, at the end, that is, later on, ishtekach kipe, the jewelry were found, the iyakur. And not only had they been found, but they had now increased in value. Amar Rav Nachman. Rav Nachman said, "Hadre kipe lemaraihu, let the jewelry go back to its owner. Hadra apadna lemara, and let the furniture go back to its owner." Now, if we just take a look at this section, the section labeled 1 Aleph Bet and Gimel on the page on the Rivadim page in front of you, you can see that it has two parts. The first part is a natural part that's told in Aramaic, the story that what happened, how Rav Nachman paskened, the guy didn't want to pay, Rav Nachman went to his house, confiscated property to pay for it, and then we have the addendum at the end that the jewelry in the end was found, the discovery of the jewelry was complicated by the fact that it now increased in value, so you would think that if the man whose property had been confiscated to pay for the jewelry finds the jewelry, and he can say, well, I gave my furniture at price X, but now I found the jewelry and it's mine, then really he's going to earn on the deal. He's going to profit from his... And we're being asked here by Mike Fisher from Sunny Passaic whether this is a Shomer Chinam. Let's assume that it's a Shomer Chinam. Let's assume that. So Rav Nachman is saying the Shomer is not going to benefit from this circumstance, of his finding the jewelry that I've now evaluated in opposite his furniture. But the jewelry will go back to its owner, and the furniture will go back to its owner, and that's it. Now, Rav Nachman's statement at the end is a regular maimra, but it's in Aramaic because it's a continuing story with this Am Haaretz who lost the jewelry and didn't know what happened to it. And this is the end of the first section of the sugya. You can see how different it is than the sugyas that we've learned, where the maimras were short and they were in Hebrew. Mike is asking, our Mishnah said the item is stolen or lost. That's right, this is lost. This is a case where the jewelry was lost and has now been found again. That's right. Now, in the second part of our sugya, Rava says, and Rava is Rav Nachman's Talmud, okay? So Rava is reflecting, I didn't understand what you wrote, Mike. It's what you wrote is not near Nachman. Not Shia. Well, I see. But when, whether it's Shia or not, depends on how it was guarded. For instance, in this case, when the guardian says, Lo Yadana, I don't know where I put it, then he's negligent. But if a guardian said, I know where I put it, but it's lost, it got lost, I don't know how it got lost, then is a Shomer Chinam is patur from Aveda. But here, he wouldn't be patur from Aveda because he didn't guard the way he's supposed to guard, and he says, I don't know what I did with it. So he's therefore liable, even though he's a Shomer Chinam. In any event, Rava is commenting on what Rav Nachman paskins, and he says, Amar Rava, Hava Yatevna Kamed Rav Nachman, I was sitting before Rav Nachman when he paskined this Shaila, Upirkin Hamafkid Hava, and at that time we were learning Perek Hamafkid, just as we are now over Itim Network. Rava was learning Hamafkid from Rav Nachman. The Amarile, and I said to Rav Nachman, after he paskened what he did, I said to him, based on our perek, Shilem, Velo Ratza Alishava, that if the guardian pays and didn't want to take an oath that he didn't know what happened to the lost or stolen object, then once he pays, when something is found later, the found object belongs to the guardian because he paid the owner for what was lost. So in our case, the man paid the owner of the jewelry. Jay says, isn't it strange because Hamafkid was different back then? Well, Hamafkid, he means we were learning the Perek of Mishnah and possibly the Brightot of Hamafkid, which was the same as it is for us. So Rava says, in our case also, the guardian who lost the jewelry, he paid for the jewelry with his furniture. So now that the jewelry has been found, the jewelry should be his. And the fact that it's gone up in value is merely a matter of his good fortune. And why should he be penalized for something that over which he had no control? And Rava reports to us that when he said that to Rav Nachman, Velo Adarli, he didn't respond to me. He didn't even respond to my question. And Rava then comments, Vishafir Avad Delo Adarli. And Rav Nachman, that he did not respond to me. Meaning now, looking back at it, Rava says, I understand that he didn't respond for a very good reason. But Rava doesn't tell us why. What was so good about the fact that Rav Nachman did not respond to him? So the Stamma de Gemara comes in now and interprets Rava's words. And the Gemara asks, "My ta'ama, what is the reason why it was so good that Rav Nachman didn't even respond to Rava?" And he answers, "Hatam Lo atreche leveidina. Hacha atreche leveidina." That in the case of Hamafkid, where the guy who paid, the guardian who paid, gets ownership of the was that he paid willingly of his own volition and initiative, and he wasn't forced to come to court in order to extract the payment out of him against his will. And therefore, he gets the rights of the double damages when the guardian... But in this case, this Poshea, this guardian who was acting irresponsibly, he didn't come forward and say, I'll pay. He was forced by Rav Nachman to pay for the jewelry that he had lost. And therefore, since he caused people this trouble of having to go to the court. And Rav Nachman was troubled with having to deal with this case, which he should not have had to deal with in the first place. Then this fellow does not get the rights to own the property that when it's found, but rather the whole process is reversed, and the jewelry goes back to its owner, and the furniture goes back to its owner, and that's the way things are. So this is how the natural sugya comes to its conclusion here. Later on here, we have a question. Jay is saying, what would have happened if the price had gone down? Could the original owner say that he does not want the jewelry back? That's an excellent question. And my assumption is, based on the logic that the Gemara has given, that he could. Yes, he could. After all, the whole reason why we're giving a knas here to the guardian who lost it is because he forced people to come to a Beit Din. So why should he gain by getting his property back when it's going to be more valuable than the jewelry? That would seem that would be a knas in the wrong direction. And so the logic would be that the owner would have that right. Now, after the Gemara has dealt with this, and then it goes on to ask about an implication that comes out of this statement. In number three in the sugya, and you see that the reason why we numbered it the way we did is that number one is the original story. Number two is the hichachasut of Rava relating to what Rav Nachman paskin, with the addendum of the stoma in two bet. And then in three is the attempt of the Gemara to learn a halakhic principle out of the psak halakha of Rav Nachman. Lememra, says the Gemara, lememra is a technical term used by the stoma de Gemara to mean, can we effectively draw an implication from the psak that was given in the following way? Lememra de Savar Rav Nachman de Shuma Hadar. From this, can we conclude that according to the Svara of Rav Nachman, that confiscation of property can always be reversed? Shane Hatam, says the Gemara, no, you can't conclude that. That was a different case. De Shuma de Ta'ut Hava. Because in this case, the confiscation of the property, the confiscation of the furniture to pay for the jewelry, was by mistake. Because really, the jewelry was present all the time. The jewelry was lost to the knowledge of the guardian, but the jewelry was there. Nothing, it hadn't really been lost. And therefore, there is no case here of that's relevant to the principle of whether or not confiscation can be reversed or not. And with this, our sugya comes to a conclusion. Now, when we take a look at this sugya, we can see several different rules for the Stama de Gemara. The first rule we can see is explanation of the words of an Amora, explanation of Rava. What is the pshat, why it is that Rava felt that Rav Nachman did well not to comment? And that's really standard Perush HaMemra of Rava. The second function of the Stama, which we have here in front of us, is the desire of the Stama to conceptualize from Rav Nachman's psak to a svara that is not only conceptual and abstract but general, that can be applied in other circumstances. And this is one of the fundamental roles of Stama de Gemara opposite the Amoraim, which is to take individual piskei halakha that were given in individual specific cases and to conceptualize from them into principles that are what we might call vested and portable. They can be applied freely by Chachamim in other cases, because the concept becomes, as it were, a more pure expression of what the original Psak Halakha was. Now, this process is problematic. It's problematic because we know that in quite a number of cases in the Gemara, we have a certain Psak Halakha of an Amora, and the Gemara attempts, or even a later Amora attempts, to derive a concept from what the Psak Halakha was, and comes the Gemara and says, no, don't do that. Lav b'firushit mara la michlala. That the original Amora did not say this general principle. He only paskened in a given case, and others wanted to learn from the given case a general principle. And he didn't hold by this general principle, the original Amora. He only held in this specific case because of the circumstances. And so when we have a movement from a specific case to a general principle, we always have to ask ourselves, is the leap from the specific to the general justified? Does it hold water? Or is the generalization moved beyond what the pshat of the original psak would allow? So that's really here the Gemara is suggesting a conceptualization and then it's rejecting it, not because it holds the conceptualization may not necessarily be true. It's saying that you can't necessarily conclude it because we have reason to say that in our case it's different because the confiscation was done in a mistaken way. And therefore it's pushing aside the necessity of the conclusion, but not necessarily that the conclusion itself might not be apropos. Now, if you take a look at sugya number 6, we have a question from Jay. According to that final logic, maybe the owner would have to take back the jewelry even if it went down in value. Well, that's right. That may be the case. But as you see, it's not clear. Because Rav Nachman's intention in his Psak Halacha was to give a knas to the poshea. So it could be... So it could be that the knas has to hold in all directions, or it could be that it doesn't. We can get as far as in both directions. We can create stama on top of this sugya, and that's basically what the Rishonim were going to do. The Rishonim will then take this discussion in the Gemara and take it a step further to each to other cases that have not been discussed yet. Please come say hello. Just walked into the room is Rabbi Unterman, who's the principal of Hebrew Academy. Rabbi Unterman, I'm now broadcasting to a group of individuals to all over the U.S. and Canada who are learning Hamaskil here on the internet. I thanked you and your school for the use of your facilities. And I'll, you know. Okay. So,
Rabbi.
Yes.
So it appears to me that just without telling the truth, that's enough. It depends if we accept the conclusion about the truth. If we accept the conclusion that is assumed upon the state, then it has to go back to the owner in any case. We don't accept the conclusion. So, however, to be shown in the question, will show whether they accept the conclusion even though there's no proof of the conclusion.
See, the issue is going to be. How do we look at this last answer of the Gemara? Do we see it as an answer which the Rishonim called the Shinuya, an answer simply for form, an answer just to the Yosei de Chovan to push away the conclusion as not necessarily so? Or do we see the answer as being a fundamental statement by the Gemara of its policy in this area? And we know that some Rishonim didn't hold by Shinuya. They would paskin even against Shinuya, but they wouldn't paskin certainly against the statement of the Stamid Gemara, which was fundamental statement of Halacha. So the methodology of the Rishonim, how they're going to look at various parts of the Gemara, the Stamid Gemara, will play a major role in the way that they're going to extend the sugya to other cases. Miriam is asking, is there a limited time to this going back to the original owners? If it were found after 10 years later, would the items go back? And I think that our conclusion would have to be yes, because the fact that the story uses the term lasof in the end of the circumstances, but it doesn't give us any time limit. If the time was a relevant factor, then the Gemara presumably would have related that to us. And the fact that no time is mentioned would seem to indicate that time is not a factor, and the procedure would be reversed regardless of how long it took. Now let's take a look at the next sugya, sugya number 6. It's a short one. It's more like an addendum to sugya 5. It kind of spells out a little bit more of what we're talking about. And there we have an amoreik sugya and a stama conclusion. The amoreik sugya says amrei nehardoi, that the rabbis from Nehardoi said. Now Nehardoi, just as an aside, doesn't mean the rabbi sitting in Nehardea, you know, enjoying beautiful downtown Nehardea. It means after Nehardea was destroyed in 258 and the Chachmei Nehardea had to wander, they went to Pumbedita, some went to the east to Shech Netziv Mechoza. They were known as a special group, the Nehardeans. So the Nehardeans said, Shuma Hadar ad Tresar Yarchei Shata, that confiscation can be reversed for up to 12 months. There, Miriam, is a good answer to your question, according to the Nehardea, to the Chachmei Nehardea. But Amemar, who is a fifth generation Amora, a teacher, one of the teachers of Rav Ashe. Amemar comes and says, Ana minar hardea ana. What do you mean? I'm from Nehardea. I can be included among the Chachmei Nehardea. An the usvirili, and I hold Shuma Hadar Leolam. I hold the confiscation can be reversed forever. It's not limited to 12 months. Go on forever. And that is this sugya, this brief little sugya, number 6, number 1 and number 2. How does this relate to the sugya that we learned in number 5? You see, it's dealing with a principle, but Rav Nachman, who paskins this case, and Rav Nachman is about the same time as Chachmei Nehardea, and Rava is one generation before Amemar, they're not relating to this principled argument at all. They're relating to the specific case only. Miriam is asking, does it then mean that I can't sell the furniture, as in the future I may have to return it if the jewelry is found, I only conditionally own it? Yes, that's a very, very good question. I don't know. That's a good question. Or if you sell it, then you may have to give the value of what you received for it back instead of the jewelry of the furniture itself. These are all questions that will be brought up later in halachic discourse among the Rishonim and the Achronim. In any event, you can see that our sugya of Rav Nachman and Rava do not relate to the principal discussion of Chachmei Nehardea or Amemar, because if they would have related to it, they would have had to say what Levasof means, that at the end of the case, when is the end of the case? Is it according to Kol HaDeot, or is it only according to Amemar? Is it after the 12 months would have expired? And Jay is saying, maybe the two shumas of the two sugyot are different. Well, we have no reason to assume that. I mean, we have no reason to assume that, because the Gemara on sugya number 5 says shuma, uses the term shuma, and immediately upon that brings the machloket in sugya number 6, which relates to shuma as the same thing. I don't understand why we want to see them as separate concepts. But look at the conclusion of sugya number 6. Sugya number 6 ends with number 3, hilchata, that what is the halacha in the end? Shuma hadar leolam. Confiscation can always be returned. Mishum shene'amar, because it says in the pasuk in Devarim, asita hayashar vehatov. Do always what is right, what is just, and good. Meaning, if it's possible to undo a confiscatory act by the court and put everything back the way it was so that everyone wins, that is certainly preferable to allowing people to walk around with feelings that they had jewelry that they lost to Ploni, and Ploni has bad feelings about furniture he lost to Almoni, and the court ends up being between people. Better go back to what the original case was if it's possible, and so people don't walk away scarred. Now this last statement of the Gemara that begins with the word vehilchata is a late addition into the Gemara. Generally speaking, when you have the word vehilchata in the Gemara, it's a psak of the Geonim, which is quite a while after the Amoraim, of course, possibly 150 years later, that the Gemara is paskening this issue. And we didn't see any reflection of that, of course, in sugya number 5, which is quite different. The sugya number 5, at the end of sugya number 5, though, we do have the question asked by the Sama, which may be aware of what the Gemara says in sugya 6, Lememra de Savar Rav Nachman de Shuma Hadar. Can we conclude from this Amoraic source that Rav Nachman held that Shuma, confiscation, will always be returned? Because the Gemara is, although it has made a conclusion conceptually of its own, if it can anchor its conceptual definition in the statement of an Amora, then that certainly would be preferable from the Gemara's point of view. Okay, we have, Mike is asking, forever, what about Yovel, or the king dies with the Kohen Gadol? Okay, now, what you're doing here is you're asking, can we cross-reference various areas of halakha to see what it means that a period is over? Because you're asking about the death of a Kohen Gadol, which is something relevant for a Rotzeach Mishkaga, who's gone to an Ir Miklat. So you're asking, well, if the Kohen Gadol's death, in the case of the Rotzeach, ends his Galut, and he can leave the Ir Miklat without fear of, we say, that the death of the Kohen Gadol should also be the end of the period in which a confiscation can be returned. And what you're doing, Mike, is attempting to conceptualize various areas of halakha, one in compared to the other, and see if you can build an overall conceptual system which will be applicable in all areas of halakha. But you have to be very, very careful when you suggest that, because it could be that the various areas of halakha have different criteria, different conceptual criteria, in which the death of a Kohen Gadol will have no relevance whatsoever to confiscation of property, because the confiscation of property, remember, is done by the Beit Din. Why should the Beit Din be affected by the death of a Kohen Gadol? The status of a Rotzeach Mishkaga in the Ir Miklat has nothing to do with the Beit Din. It has to do with the built-in fear of the Rotzeach Mishkaga from the Goel Adam, who runs to the Ir Miklat, and we say that fear will come to conclusion with the Kohen Gadol, who should have prayed better so that there wouldn't be Retzach Mishkaga in the first place. So it could be that there are various criteria at the various halachic areas, and they should not be connected to each other. Miriam is asking, does the death of either party and the inheritance by heirs have any bearing on forever? Well, Miriam, your question is superior, because if you look back at the sugya that we learned last time, we learned sugya number 3. That is exactly the question of the sugya. The sugya number 3 asks what happens with the relationship of the guardian and the owner in the second generation. What about the guardian to the children of the owner, or the children of the owner to the guardian, or the children of the owner to the children of the guardian? And this ends up in a teku in sugya number 3. So what you're asking is, how would this apply to our sugya? And the answer is, well, if you have a teku in sugya number 3, we're obviously going to still have a teku in sugya 5 or 6, and the Rishonim would have to deal with this. When Mike asks, don't debts end at Yovel? Well, as you know, debts end at Shemitah. But that doesn't mean that this would be considered a debt. This is a debt that's been imposed by the court, not a debt that's been imposed between people. Jay is asking, of course, Ve'asita Hayashar implies it is not an enforceable halakha, but rather Lifni Mishurat Adin. Not necessarily, Jay. It could be that what we're saying is that the court here would always put the clock back, because the court wants to operate Ve'asita Hayashar Ve'atov. Not that we should operate privately, Asita Yashar V'Yatov, as private citizens, but rather that the court is doing it as a legal principle of the judicial system. Yosef Lachterman from Dallas is asking, I'm confused about the V'Hilchata. The Gonin added to the Gemara, who and how is driving this law from the Pasuk? Why? I'm not sure I understand what your question is. In other words, the Gaonim also have a right to learn Torah, and they're adding when they paskin, they're giving their reason for their psak. They're paskining on top of the Amarik Sugi, and they're telling you why they paskin that way. And they, even today, I mean, you'll have poskim today that will paskin a certain issue and will give a reason for it by quoting a pasuk as a remez to a concept that they consider important in their psak. Dov is asking from Brooklyn, then why does it say Hilchata? And Hilchata is a term that Gaonim used to mean the final Psak Halacha. The final Psak Halacha. And it's added into many sugyot. I think the word Hilchata must occur in Shas a couple of hundred times. It's like a final layer that's been added to bring the sugya down to Psak Halacha. Dov was asking, that was a question of Rabbi Kelman's point. That is, I don't understand. Now that you're saying,
he's asking, I claim that it's suggested that the suggestion should have been the question on me, but I can't think of just a look at that.
That's an interesting point.
In general, there's an athletic, I believe, the Rambam and the Ramban, whether we can enforce the Zimashur of Adi. So it could be the first thing is the Zimashur of Adi, not the Halakha. But there's a separate machlok of whether you can enforce a halakha like we can assure to be. It may still only be on the individual, but if I still claim my original point, I would think that they can say that's what one is supposed to. I'm not sure, I don't know, that they can enforce that ruling.
Okay. these are all good questions, but they're not relevant to the study of the sugya. They're relevant to the study of the development of the halakha in the post-Talmudic period during the Gaonim, Rishonim, and Achronim, which is beyond the purview of our shiurim here. Now, Shmuel is asking, Yosef is bothered that the Gaonim still were able to inject themselves into the text. Wasn't the Talmud completely codified by the end of the 6th century, Ravin and Ravashe? The Gaonim came 200 years later. Okay, if that's the issue, then let's relate to that issue. That's very important. First of all, Ravina and Ravashe, as the editors of the Gemara, is based on a statement of the Gemara in Bava Metzia, Daf Pevav Amud Bet, which says, Ravina v'Ravashe Sof Hora'a. Rashi, commenting on that, says, Sof Kol Ha'amoraim, that they were the end of the Amoraim, who edited the statements of the Amoraim. But Rashi is not referring there to the Stam of the Gemara. He's referring to the Torah Ha'amoraim. Now, Rav Shriva Gaon holds that it's not Ravina and Ravashe, but rather it's Ravina Baravuna and Rav Asi, or Rav Yossi, who were two generations after Rav Ashi and Ravina, in the end of the 8th generation. They died about the year 500, because Rav Ashi dies, his colleague, several years later. But Rav Shriva holds that the editors of the Gemara were the editors of the Amoraim, that is, were two generations later, Rav Asi and Ravina. But none of this discussion about who edited this Torah Amoraim is relevant to the Stam of the Gemara, because the Stam of the Gemara is a later addition into the Gemara, right after they're the students of the Amoraim, as Rav Shvira says, that even though they're not Horah, they're Krovim the Horah, and that they were added then into the Sugya, generation after generation. It continued to accumulate, just like before, only their role was the explanation of Svarot. Now, when you ask, how could the Gaonim insert themselves into the text, the Gaonim did not think that they were inserting themselves into the text. The Gaonim probably wrote in the margin, Hilchata, a halachic note saying what the psak was, and a later sofer, a scribe or a copyist of some sort, wrote that note in them from the margin into the text of the Gemara. And therefore, it looks to us today like it's a piece of the Gemara, but it's not a piece of the Gemara. It came from the margin. This happens a lot in Kitvei Yad. Miriam is asking, just to verify, the word vihilchata always means a statement of Gaonim. To the best of my knowledge, almost always. I don't want to use the term always, because I haven't, in the last 2 days, I haven't checked all of them. But my experience tells me from the sugas that I've learned that hilchata generally is a psak halacha of the Gaonim. Jay is asking, who, when did edit the stama? Did various masechtot have different ending times? The answer is absolutely yes. The stoma, we don't know if the stoma was ever edited. That's number one. Because we have no Rav Shvira, who in his Igeret describes how it developed, that it was added generation by generation, does not mention anyone closing the stoma de Gemara. So that's one issue. But if you look at certain masechtot, like Nedarim and Nazir, you see that their language is Aramaic from the Gaonic period, much later than the Aramaic of the regular stama, and it's well known in the yeshivas that Nedarim and Nazir is a special lashon, and that's the lashon of more of the Gaonim. So the stama de Gemara is really an open question today. No one really knows who edited it and how it was incorporated into the text. I can tell you that one way that we'll eventually know is by doing study of the stama of the Gemara to try and, by its languages, its idioms, in order to determine if there were, let's say, stama from Surah as opposed to stama from Pumbedita, stama from Mochoza, or is all of the stama of one source. All of these are open questions. No one really knows, and I was hoping that the invasion of Iraq by the American forces would allow us to enter and uncover the archives of Surah and Pumbedita and look at the Gemaras the way they were in the year 500 and 550 and 600. Unfortunately, people are still blowing themselves up there, and we're not able to go there and do that archaeology. But maybe one day we'll discover the archives, and then we'll be able to follow the process of the accumulation of the stoma a little bit more carefully. Dov is asking, given that rabbis move from place to place, how would the language used prove the place written? Because I'll give you an example, Dov. We have in the Gemara an expression, Bishlama Leman. Bishlama Leman means that a certain source or opinion that's been expressed works well according to one opinion and another argument and not to the other. But we have another expression called Hanicha Leman, which is exactly the same in its meaning as Bishlam Leman. Why does the Gemara use two different languages for exactly the same purpose? And so many scholars are of the opinion that it's because Hanicha Leman and Bishlam Leman are two different languages for the same process because they came from two different yeshivas. And we have other examples of this in the Stama, that different languages would be used for the same process. Now, one thing we know is that there were different dialects of Aramaic. There was a southern dialect and there was a northern dialect. But the copyists kind of washed out the differentiations between these over time. And therefore, it's mixed up in the sugyas, and it's hard for us to identify northern dialect of Aramaic versus southern. But eventually, God willing, with the discovery of more manuscripts and the more research into the sugyas, maybe we'll be able to sort it out and find our way back to an understanding of what exactly is going on in the stoma. Are there any further questions at this time? Jay is asking, as per my email message, let us know if next Thursday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time works for you. Yes, next week I'm going to be in Chicago teaching at Hillel Torah. And there we'll be finishing our in-service at about 12:30 Chicago time, which is around 1:15, 1:30 Toronto time, and then we'll go on the air at 2 o'clock Eastern time, if that's good for everyone. So you'll all respond to Jay, and he will let me know one way or another. Yosef is saying, so we assume the copyists were just the copiers, weren't they? Okay, that's a very important question, Yosef. The answer to your question is that copyists, Sofrim, were very often trained to be just that, copyists, and they were not supposed to understand because many times by understanding, they might insert their own opinions into the copying of the text, and they're just to copy it word for word. The problem a copyist has is when he has a manuscript and on the edge of the manuscript there's a notation from a Talmid Chacham, he doesn't know whether this notation on the side is a correction of the text or an interpretation of the text. So he has to decide what to do. If it's a correction of the text and he leaves it out of his new copy, then he's foiled what the Talmid Chacham wanted by putting the correction there. On the other hand, if it's a pirush and he puts it in, the worst that can happen is there'll be another line there, and all the Talmid Chachamim will read it in any event will know that it's a comment and not part of the Ikar Gemara. So in many cases, the copyist simply added it into the text, and you can follow the history of Kitvei Yad. One of the world experts on Kitvei Yad is Shama Friedman, and he demonstrates in his writings how you can follow families of manuscripts and see how they develop from one generation to the next as the copyists struggle with how to copy the text and deal with the notations that are in the margins. Eitan is asking me, what is his name again? His name is Shama Friedman. And he's written quite a lot. You go into the internet and type in Shama Friedman and you'll find him there. Okay, I think that this pretty much brings to an end our lesson for today. Be'ezrat Hashem, we will be meeting next week at 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time instead of at 12:30. I will send to Rabbi Kelman the sugya that I've selected for our last meeting next week. And I look forward to seeing you all then. And I sign off from beautiful downtown Ottawa in the Great White North. Kol Tuv to everyone. Bye-bye.